Welcome to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers into the industry. You can find this show at spilalkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 42 of Real Talk last week was NMHC, and you know there was optimism, not surprised, optimism by brokers, optimism by owner-operators, and what else do you expect when people are traveling all over the country to San Diego? They're going to have optimism. We had the same optimism last year at NMHC in Vegas, and look how the year turned out. I'm not saying it's going to be the same year this year as last year, but this first quarter is a carryover of the frozen markets in multifamily. We did close one deal recently for Gelt in Denver called Allure. A couple others about to close later this month. So there is some deal activity, but it's nothing like what we saw in the prior years. But those that went to NMHC feel that there will be an opening of the market, but I think it's just, that's what they hope. I don't think they have anything that they're pointing their finger to. Continuing on with the multifamily discussion from last week and into this week, I have my good friends and client, Mitch Paskover and Max Sharkansky from Trion Properties. Unbelievable story, starting with 12 units just before the GFC. Today, they have 7,000 units. They're on the West Coast, they're in the Southeast. Personally, they moved from Los Angeles to Miami. We get into that. We talk about the differences between GFC days and today's market. It's a wide-ranging conversation that I hope you will enjoy.
Welcome to another edition of Real Talk. I'm here with my good friends, Max Sharkansky, and oh, I like Mitch P on the video here, not Mitch Paskover. Is that your rap name, Mitch P?
Well, you know, we were having so many issues logging in. I was just trying to type as fast as I can. You know, it's been a tough process, but here we are.
Yeah, well, those watching on YouTube or any other platform will see your rap name and the beautiful ode to Magic Johnson behind you.
That's right.
A born and bred Laker fan.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, grew up watching Magic. We could argue. I still think he's the best Laker. I'm sure some people will be offended by that. But to me, he's the best Laker.
No, I don't argue with that. The only thing I argue with is that the best team that resides at crypto.com arena are the Los Angeles Clippers.
Almost.
Based on
let's end the podcast right now.
All right, let's get into real estate. I didn't even say your company name, Trion. And you know, Max and Mitch, I remember meeting you guys. It's over 10 years ago. I don't know if it's 15 years ago. Max, did you do the Shark Tank for a Jewish Federation event for some deal?
I did. It was the first one ever. And, you know, not to toot my own horn, but I think that may have been the best one ever. that was where Brian Shurkin and Jillian were the sharks. Mm. And I was presenting a deal that we were buying in San Diego for $100 a door that we were just stealing. And they didn't want to do the equity on it, but we wound up doing an unbelievable number on that deal. So yeah, that was a really fun Shark Tank. But right, you and I first met was during the GFC, and it wasn't JFED. It was the other one that they used to do breakfast at the Peninsula Hotel.
Yeah, Moriah Society for American Jewish University.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Does that still exist?
I don't know, but we should kick it back, get it back going.
Yes, exactly.
Well, that's great. So for those that don't know about Trion, although I feel like everyone, at least in LA, knows about Trion, and now that you guys have moved to Miami, and I want to talk about that move, about Trion. If there's anyone that's been sleeping under a rock and they don't know Trion, one of you, Mitch P, Max, talk about Trion and what you guys are all about.
Sure. I'll give you some history on the name, but Max and I have been childhood friends for years. We've known each other through our parents, and we reconnected in college, and I actually went to USC, Max went to Loyola, and that's where the name Trion Properties comes from, a Trojan and a Lion. And just by way of background, I graduated SC, I went into real estate. My first job was actually for Glenn Sonnenberg and Mitch Clairfield, who I'm both of you, you know, I'm sure you know both of them. And we were doing bridge lending at the time. And then I moved over to HFF. Max went to Marcus and Millichap doing investment sales for multifamily. I was doing debt and equity for multifamily at HFF. And then, you know, we started talking in 04, 05. And both of us wanted to eventually move over from the brokerage side to the principal side. And then in 06, we finally opened our company, Trion Properties, bought our first deal in 2005, and it was a 12-unit deal on Vineland, and we kind of started our company from there.
That's amazing. And how many units do you have now?
6,500 with another 350 closing next week. So we'll be at 6,850. By the end of January, and you know, hopefully 10,000 in the next 18 to 24 months.
Wow, incredible growth. So let's go back to those days. So you said, Mitch, 2006 is when you bought your first deal?
Yes.
So what were the first couple of years like? So we were at the top of the mountain, and then everything came crashing down a year or two later. What were you guys doing during those GFC days?
We I'll take this one. So we actually were fortunate. We had great timing. We built a small portfolio in that 05, 06, 07 period. And we saw the writing on the wall, and we decided to sell the portfolio. And as we were selling the portfolio, we changed our acquisition strategy from buying non-performing debt. I'm sorry, from buying value out of multifamily to trying to buy non-performing debt secured by multifamily. Because our perspective, the ownership at large was zombie ownership because a lot of these properties were underwater, and cap rates were going up, rents were going down. There was no point in doing value add. People were just trying to make ends meet. They weren't trying to pay extra for granite countertops and vinyl plank flooring. And we felt that it would be significantly more profitable to work in distress anyways. And we were a little bit early. We started calling on the banks in 2008. And at that point, you know, you're calling them and they say, okay, we'll sell it to you for like 95 cents on the dollar. And we say, well, the asset's probably worth about 80, 85 cents of what your loan is. So we'll pay you 60, 65 cents. So you're pissing off a lot of people at that point and they're hanging up on you. But then about a year later, they don't. And we did our first acquisition in 2009, summer of 2009. We bought a portfolio of notes from East West Bank, and they also financed it. So that's one other thing we were doing. We were putting debt on the debt, and that snowballed. And we did about 20 deals during the downturn in 9, 10, 11, 12. We did about 15 non-performing note deals and about 5 REOs. So during that period, for 4 years, we did not buy a single property from a private individual organization. Everything was bank, Fannie, Freddie, CMBS, servicer. And then coming out of the downturn, we just went back to the value add business. And then we started crossing state lines, and, you know, we went to Oregon and we went to Colorado, and then I moved to Miami, and now we're in 8 states and 13 markets.
And just to back up, Andrew, you know, initially when Max and I started buying our first deals in 05, 06, 07, typically we were at that point really focused on buying rent control buildings. And eventually that business model was tough, right? Because, you know, you model all these value add deals and you obviously are going through your assumptions. And I think you're going through and saying, hey, look, we're going to spend X on renovations. We'll get a pop of Y, and then our renovated units are going to be Z. But when you buy rent control deals, there's a lot of unknown variables that were in the cards. And eventually we decided to just buy, you know, value add deals with no rent control. And that's what led to us buying in other states. We started moving to the Pacific Northwest and then Denver. And then Max was the first one to move to Florida because we started targeting the Southeast. And yeah, our vision for the company is we wanted to try to grow to 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 units. And it was too tough being a West Coast-based company focused on California, given the political issues on multifamily, rent control. So we wanted to really expand the business. And that's why we moved to the Southeast. And then now we're based in LA for the West Coast assets and then Miami for the Southeast assets.
Yeah. Look, thanks for that background and overview. And there's a lot to unpack. And you know, I actually want to go back to what you guys were saying of, because it was similar to what when I founded my firm coming out of the GFC and how every day I was busy in representing clients in note purchases, whether they were one-off note purchases or buying these tapes of loans and portfolio of loans and, you know, either no DD or very short DD. And it was, that's what monopolized our days, right? From 2009 through even 12. Do you think we're going to see those days? Because at the end of the fourth of last year, I was involved in multiple high profile loan acquisitions on the office side, but I have not seen that yet on the multifamily side.
It's going to be few and far between. I mean, if you think about what this market is, this macro market versus the GFC, you're talking about a 3.8% unemployment market versus a 10% unemployment market. It was the worst recession, the second worst recession in American history, the worst recession since the Great Depression. It was a recession so deep that it caused a global financial crisis. And you had vacancy, you had rents plummeting, people were leaving, you had people that were from Mexico that were going back to Mexico because there were no more jobs here. I mean, it was a disaster. That's just not going to happen. We had, back then we had 500 bank failures. Now we had 5 bank failures. So the magnitude just isn't there. We are seeing some interesting opportunities on a rifle shot basis that we're taking advantage of. And we're doing that mostly with sellers who need liquidity and they're just in a bit of a pinch. So I think you're going to see more of that. And that's where the opportunity is going to lie. Like this property that we're closing on in Florida in a couple of weeks, somebody just had to sell it. And they met the market and we're buying it at 150 a door and a 7 cap. That feels really good. Mm-hmm. So we think there's going to be a little bit more of that. And that's what we're going to be looking for throughout the year.
And I think the big difference is back then is you had an issue with liquidity, right? I think Fannie and Freddie at that time were having issues on their SFR portfolios. They were in conservatorship and they really weren't as active on the multifamily side as they are now or when they were in 06, 07, right? Right now, you still have a lot of liquidity from Fannie and Freddie. You can still go out and get a 10-year or 5-year fixed rate loan and you know be priced at 180, 190 over the 5 or 10-year treasury and get a loan in the high 5s, low 6s, depending on affordability, et cetera. You didn't really have that back then. And I think that's why, back to your point, Andrew, you are seeing some incredible opportunities if you are an office owner because you can't get a loan. There is no liquidity for any kind of office transaction, even at 30, 40%. You know, I'm sure you saw the press, but the Aon, you know, tower sold for 70% off kind of the peak pricing and the seller had to carry paper. There's just no debt at all for that.
Well, I know that deal intimately well because I was buyer's counsel.
There you go.
Yeah. And we are not seeing that type of discount. We're not seeing that type of distress yet in multifamily. I say yet, but I guess you guys don't think we're going to see it in multifamily.
Well, no, I mean, look, you are seeing distress in the sense of pricing from peak is down 20, 25%. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, like Max said, it's one and far between, but a lot of sellers right now, what they're trying to do is they're going out to the market, trying to sell an asset, and maybe they're trying to get 170 a door. The market comes back at 150 a door. They're expecting 200 a door, or that's their basis, and they do not need to sell. They go back to their equity partner and they say, look, guys, let's just go ahead and buy another SOFR cap for another year or two, stabilize operations, wait for rates to come back down, and then we'll sell the asset, right? So you're just not seeing as much pressure, I think, as you are as an office owner or other product types on the multifamily side.
So let's get into what you just mentioned in with the variable interest rate loans and having to buy a rate cap extension. And I'm talking to clients multiple times a day on the maturity date is imminent, or to buy another cap is imminent, and they need more runway. They don't want to put this money in unless if they see a light at the end of the tunnel. Some properties, they fear that there is no light at the end of the tunnel. But if they don't buy a rate cap extension because they didn't buy a rate cap for the entire three-year term, that could trigger a recourse. You know, all of these discussions I'm having with clients now, and how do we position ourselves as borrowers vis-a-vis the lenders? And I'm telling them, look, it really depends who the lender is. Are they keeping it on their balance? Have they kept it on their balance sheet? Are you working with the servicer? Is the lender well capitalized? It's not a science, it's an art. So I don't know what your experiences have been with your variable interest rate loans, but any thoughts on how to deal with these variable interest rate lenders on a fact pattern that I just articulated?
Sure. I mean, look, so let's start with debt funds, right? Debt funds are providing a number of these variable rate loans, value add deals. You got to remember that a lot of these debt funds who are providing loans and selling them as CLOs have a line lender. And a line lender, whether it's Wells or whatever major bank, they have certain kind of covenants themselves. So I think a lender will work with you on a few things if you're able to, at least you have to go ahead and buy another 12-month SOFR cap, right? If you go back to the lender and say, look, we just don't have any liquidity, we can't buy a cap, we can't do anything, we need you to extend the loan, I think it's going to be a quick no. But if you go back to a lender and there's a business plan, something that you can say, look, our NOI is $3 million today. We're going to spend $2 million left in the renovation reserve. We'll grow the NOI to $3.3 million. We'll go ahead and buy a 12-month SOFR cap, but we need you guys to extend the loan, and we don't meet the debt yield covenant test, or we don't meet the LTV test, right? What can you guys do for us? We need to have you reduce the debt yield test, but we'll pay down the loan by 3-5%. I think if it's a give and take and the lender feels that your interests are aligned and you're willing to put some money in, they'll work with you. But if you're not going to do that, I think it's very tough to get any kind of relief from anything that's in the loan documents.
Yeah, Max, what are your thoughts? Because my conversations with clients, if I tell them, if you need more time, you're going to have to buy down the loan. You're going to have to reduce the principal. 3-4% maybe. I've seen even up to 10%, but a lot of clients just don't want to make that bet because they're concerned that even they don't want to spend good money after bad.
So as you know, I think as we've all just discussed and we can all agree on, there has to be a quid pro quo. Right. So pay down is one way to do it. As you know, you helped us out with that deal in Orlando. We were finally able to locate some preferred equity. Our hot button on that deal is we wanted more term. That was a very interesting kind of unique deal because we had a master lease with Disney on a three-year loan. Disney vacated a year and a half into it and gave us the keys back, which was expected. The master lease ended and that was part of the business plan. And now we're in the middle of a macro event and a down cycle. So we need more time to renovate because we're not going to be able to take out the loan in the 18 months we have left. So we go back to our lender And there's a couple things we could do. We can either do a pay down, or we could do a credit enhancement with some sort of recourse or something like that. We don't want to do that. So we think the best thing to do is to do a pay down. So we're now engaged with a preferred equity investor slash lender, whatever you want to call it. And we're going to do a 5% pay down of the loan, roughly. And in exchange for the 5%, we're adding what looks like it's going to be a year or two to the term of the loan, which gives us opportunity to execute on the business plan and live to see another day. And hopefully when rates normalize, which they will, I think we all can agree on that. The Federal Reserve has said that the neutral rate is 2.5%, and it will probably get back to 2.5% sometime soon here. So when the world normalizes, we can refire, we could sell. And I think that's the way a lot of people should be looking at it.
And I think it's really, you got to really be specific about the deals in the submarkets, right? The deal in Orlando, we feel good about, and we feel that if we put more money in, there's going to be a good return for it. Why? Because A, insurance has skyrocketed in the Southeast, right? We used to pay $700-$800 a door, and now it's almost $2,800 a unit, number one. Number two, what Max talked about, rates we think will stabilize as well. But that particular deal, the lender said, look, if you pay us down by 5%, the loan was 5 years. It had basically a three-year term plus two extensions. We'll waive all of the debt yield tests, all of the LTV tests. So now you basically have an additional 2 years of runway without any covenants. Just buy a SOFR cap. And I think on that particular deal, it makes sense. But there are deals that I've heard about, and there are deals maybe located in California or other markets where maybe renovator rents have dropped so much that it doesn't make sense to put more money into the deal. So it just depends on the deal and the submarket where it's located.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had one of our equity partners call me and ask for advice on one of their deals. They said it's maturing in a year from now, December 2024. Would you do that now? And this is like 2-3 months ago. And I said, no, just wait, just buy your rate cap and wait to see what happens in August, September, October of 2024 and do it at that point. Because as of right now, you're underwater. So just wait.
Right. I think the concern with some borrowers is to write that seven-figure check for the rate cap for another year. Am I just spending money without a good result at the end of the day? And it really depends on, like what you said, Mitch. Do you have conviction in the asset? Are rents going up? Is it an asset that has an ability to, when rates come down and the overall market, the cap rate stabilize, will this asset be in a good position? And those with crystal balls feel like, you know, it may not be. And so why am I going to spend $1.5 million on a rate cap when I'm just going to be foreclosed on 12 to 18 months from now?
Right. Look, one of our friends, Max, and I were actually in New York a few months ago, just meeting with a number of lenders just to talk about portfolios and loans and any foreclosures, opportunities. And, you know, they mentioned that they had a borrower that built a brand new deal in Houston, Class A. They refinanced, they put a debt fund loan on it a few years ago, but the loan came due and they actually decided to give the keys back just because that particular market has so much supply. Rents have gone down so much, it didn't make sense to write another check to extend the loan.
So fast forwarding into 24, what is your outlook? What are certain metrics that you're looking at, maybe geographical regions you're looking at as you're plotting out the next 12 months?
Well, our existing markets are NorCal, Portland. Colorado has now become our top state. We own about 2,000 units in Colorado. Our Miami office covers Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas. We had been trying to buy in Dallas for a couple of years now, maybe a little more than that. And we just could not get comfortable with the pricing there with, you know, three caps going to four caps at $300 a door. I mean, Dallas is a market that has real risk because the lack of supply constraints. But we bought our first property in Dallas, as you know. in 2023. You represented us on it, and that was a great deal. And we're really excited about growing in Dallas. DFW might be the top growth market in the US. So that's a market where we want to scale. And we think, as in terms of new markets, Phoenix is going to have a lot of opportunity over the next 1 to 2 years. And we would love to grow into Phoenix, also for our LA office to cover. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Max, you decided to move to Miami first. And when was that, when you...
I was the pioneer. I moved in June of 2021. Mitch and I decided in the summer of 2020, you know, LA was kind of going through a thing back then, and the multifamily industry was under attack by California and Oregon, which at that time was 95% of our portfolio. So we decided to diversify, and I moved the following year.
And what about you, Mitch?
I moved a year later. So we decided at the time, both of us couldn't leave at the same time. There would have to be some kind of transition period. And then Max moved first. I moved a year later. Farhan, who you know as well, he's a partner of ours. He basically now runs the West Coast and the LA office. So he stayed back here, oversees our portfolio acquisitions on the West Coast. And then I joined Max in Miami.
Yeah. And both you guys, were you born and bred in Southern California?
Yes.
Raised in Southern California. You too, Mitch, right?
Yeah, correct.
So you've been there now for a couple of years. Obviously, we've heard all the anecdotal references of people moving. A lot, of, I guess, Miami, I would assume more from New York, but people from LA, San Francisco, moving to Miami, to Austin, to Dallas. What is it like being there? And is the grass as green as they all make it out to be?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing. You know, I don't want to beat California up too much, but it's had some problems over the past 5 to 10 years. And a lot of those problems don't really exist or exist as much over there. So you're getting away from some of the quality of life issues like the homelessness and the crime. The schools are fantastic. You've got beaches year round. I can go to the beach next week. I think I was on the beach with Mitch 2 weeks ago, and I can go to the beach in July. So you've got an entire city that's built on water, the Biscayne Bay, the beaches, boating's like a big thing if you're into that. So, you've got that piece of it. Then it's extraordinarily pro-business, very, very sparse on red tape. Very much welcoming of people moving there and starting a business there and growing a business. You get like small business tax credits, and just, it's a very, very different type of environment than SoCal or California.
Yeah. I mean, look, wife, kids, everyone loves it. Max mentioned the quality of life's amazing, you know, being on the beach. But I think more importantly is right now, Miami's really become a city that really competes with New York and LA. For example, we are in a high rise in downtown. Obviously, Miami Brickell is probably the hottest office market in the country. If you don't get to the office by 8:45, 9, you got to drive 7 floors up on the parking garage to get a parking spot. It's crazy. You know, the building's fully occupied. Everyone is gets dressed up for work. I think all the buildings are not only occupied, but people are going to work. So when you leave for lunch at 12:30, 1, there's hundreds of people walking around, you know, so it's got a great work office culture. And there's a lot of opportunities, you know, multifamily is really strong, obviously, in Florida and the Southeast. And it was just too tough for both of us to always be flying from LA to Florida and other states on a red eye for a day or day or two to kind of get a feel for the markets and see what's going on. So it's been a great move for both of us and our families.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, I almost feel like you guys as, and there's so many others out there, should like talk to government officials in LA and California as, you know, yes, you still have business here in LA, but this really shouldn't happen, right? Like to have two guys in the prime of your career, an unbelievable business, owning close to, you know, what is it, 7,000 units, and you're making a conscious effort to move across country because of better lifestyle, pro business, you know, less homelessness, or if there is homeless, you know, dealing with it. And I feel like the government officials here in Southern California, California in general, it's they almost don't want to believe that this is happening and that their head is in their sand. And we're going to wake up 5-10 years from now and businesses like yourself are going to be extinct from Southern California.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you still have people that are tied down here because of family and they just don't want to leave, and you have that element, but you try to talk to the politicians about it, and it's become so extreme at every level of government in the state, from the cities all the way up to the state, that it's just hard to get them to move off of some of these policies and ideologies that just haven't worked out. I mean, it's clearly not working and things need to go in the other direction. And we all hope that it does. And because California physically is the most beautiful state in the nation. It's just, it's an amazing, amazing place. The weather's amazing. But it's just, it's being managed very, very poorly. So you would think that with all of the statistics from the Census Bureau on people moving out, they'll start to make a change. And it seems like there are some changes happening on housing, because housing has been a huge problem and you can't build housing. And some of those things seemingly are improving a little bit. They're inching in the right direction, but they've got a long way to go. And it's going to require change. And democracy, if it's working, in theory, democracy is, you know, when things are going really bad, people will vote for change. And hopefully that will happen here. California. And I say here because I'm in LA for the week.
Yeah.
I mean, look, Andrew, I think both of us, especially me, I still miss LA. I still miss coming here. Like Max mentioned, I still think it's the most beautiful state, the resources, but it's just become really tough to operate our business. You know, we used to do ground up development here in LA, type five, you know, pretty simple stuff. We would buy right. We, you know, build and break ground within 9 months and then, you know, build 50, 60, 70 units, whatever it was. And that became too much of a challenge. You know, it just, it took us almost on our last deal, 19, 20 months just to get entitlements and break ground. It's just, it's tough to carry land without any income for that long. So, you know, Miami obviously has its positives.
Yeah. No, look, other than that, your favorite sports teams don't play there, but you can watch them when they play Miami. You know, one last topic that I want to get into is the way you guys source equity. I get a lot of inbound inquiries from clients. You know, maybe they've done most of their deals through syndications and they want to explore the JV world, or some folks are, you know, frustrated with the JV world and they want to explore syndications. I feel like you guys have done both. Can you talk about maybe deal size has a major factor, but sort of the pros and cons and how you choose whether to capitalize a deal through your syndication network versus going with an institution to provide 90-95% of the equity?
That's a great question. It depends. Okay. So let's take a step back. So going back to the GFC, all roads lead back to the GFC. We were building our business at the time and, you know, we were trying to figure out, do we want to like try to go more institutional and do more JVs and have that be our business? Do we want to, syndicate more? And what was happening at that time, which is very similar to what's happening right now, is every major institution was on the sideline. And they were, and at that time it was much worse because they were going in through their own workouts. A lot of them went out of business and there was no institutional equity. So we had the conversation of, look, we can build a database of, let's say, 1,000 investors, even though now we have more and we've gone beyond that. Using a round number, we have 1,000 investors, active investors. if the world comes to an end again, when it does come to an end again, just like it is right now, a couple hundred of them will probably still be investing. So we should consciously do that and build that out. And over, and then in the middle of that, actually the Jobs Act passed and crowdfunding became a business. We got into it immediately. Back then there were crowdfunding platforms where you could post your deal online and the investors would invest with you directly and you keep the investors. So we did that as much as we could. And we got a ton of investors that way through crowdfunding platforms. And then that later evolved where we hired our own in-house marketing people and did direct Facebook ads and Google ads. And we went to conferences. And over the years, we built a business where right now, or I should say, let's say based on tax year 2022, which we sent out in April of this year, we sent out 2,200 K-1s to all of our investors, and we've got about 1,500 investors, and that's growing. So during a period like now, you know, just like that deal you did for us, we syndicated it. And, you know, we'll go out, we'll try to find a few anchor investors, putting up $2 to $6 million checks, get a few of those, and then the rest of them, you backfill them with your 50s to 250s, you get a few 500s. And over time, you can start to syndicate $20 million equity checks. And so, you know, and when we get deals, we're usually concurrently showing them to equity groups as well who do joint ventures. And we, if we have a pretty robust pipeline of deals, yeah, we'll try to do a few JVs and a few syndications and keep it on balance.
And, you know, look, I think, Andrew, people have to remember, if you're starting out, I would recommend or tell people, I always tell people, start with syndication, right? Because I think once you start buying larger deals and you're ready to go institutional, everyone's going to ask you for your track record. And they're going to want to see not only what have you bought, but what have you sold. They want to see what deals have actually gone through a round trip. And they want to see a track record. And number two, there are two different kind of equity sources. But syndication, you actually have approval rights and major decisions. And now you're all of a sudden you're going to an institutional partner, and guess what? They actually have the major approval rights in terms of a sale, a refi, anything. So, you know, we love institutional deals as well. And it's nice having one major partner. Like you said, all of a sudden you can raise 95% of the equity and get the deal done, as opposed to calling a couple hundred investors. It's tough. But at the same time, you know, you have more flexibility. So it's kind of a give and take situation.
Yeah, but you're right. You need to walk before you run, and an institution is likely not to do business with you until you've had that track record. And most people go the syndication route, and they hit a limit as to how much they can raise. And the fact that you and, you know, the Gelts of the world and others can raise these 20 million plus equity checks is really a testament to how many coffees and lunches and breakfasts and drinks you guys have been on throughout the country. You know, I'm going to leave you with the last question here. And Mitch, I guess you sort of alluded to giving some advice, but is there any other advice if you were to give yourselves when you guys started, 15, almost 20 years ago, which is crazy, means that we're getting old. You know, there's a 25-year-old that comes into your office and says, Mitch, Max, you know, I want to get into the real estate business. I want to duplicate what you guys have done. What advice would you tell them? Max, let's start with you.
I would say try to find a few investors. Don't go look for a deal and then call your Rolodex and figure it out that way. Go find a few people. Say yes. Well, you know, so you explain to them what your thesis is, whether it's last mile industrial, multifamily, whatever you want to do. Try to put some materials together on why it will work, and, you know, make yourself look professional. It is money after all. It's people's hard-earned money that they're going to invest with you. And try to find a few investors and have those people lined up, and then go try to find a deal or two and get the ball rolling. The one thing I would recommend, which I would say is outside the box, is bring management in-house as soon as you can, if not day one. A lot of people outsource third-party management. God bless all the management companies. You know, you do a great job, but I'm a big believer that there is no better business model than self-management, owner-operator, because no one's going to care as much as you are. No one's going to control costs as well as you can. No one's going to drive NOIs as well as you will. And when you build that high-class operations team in-house, you will have a high-class company.
Great.
You know, my advice to people really is become an expert at one thing. I think I see a lot of guys talk to me like, look, we want to like branch off and do our own thing. If you're going to do multifamily, be an expert in multifamily value add, right? I think a lot of guys all of a sudden like talk about, well, maybe I'll buy industrial as well. And there's an office deal. Like, you know, if I was an investor in LP and a group who was doing multifamily all of a sudden said, look, we want to buy an industrial deal, I can go out and buy an industrial REIT, right? And be liquid. But I think it's really important to just be a master of one craft, right? Just like we are, like value add multifamily. That's all we do. We don't go out and buy industrial office or any other product types. It's just not our expertise. And I think it's really important if you have LPs invest with you, they want you to be an expert in one thing.
Yeah, that's a great point. When we started, we were buying rent control multifamily in the San Fernando Valley. So, and then from there, it grows.
Yeah, no, look, I appreciate that perspective. And I think those listening will get a lot of value in the words that you've said. And the fact that you guys are giving other people advice, I think that's a scary proposition, but that's what this world is doing. We're getting old and you guys are just so successful that you're able to. Now, on a serious note, you know, it's really a testament to, yeah, it's not just networking, but it's like giving back, being part of the community. It's how we all met each other through the organizations, whether it's charity-based or professional networking. I tell everyone, just get involved. It's a marathon. And you know, I remember meeting you guys 15 plus years ago and so many of our peers, the same thing. And I just, you know, really congratulate you guys on the success of Trion and much success in the future, other than for Mitch's Lakers. But so I root for the Lakers. My family are, they're Laker fans, but I'm a glutton for punishment.
No, look, Andrew, you're right. I mean, I think like you said, it takes a while to really cultivate relationships. And I think all three of us can talk about this, that it takes a number of meetings, coffee meetings, lunch meetings. I think people sometimes think, look, I'm going to meet somebody and right away they're going to do a deal with me. It doesn't work like that, right? And it's like you said, it took 10 plus years for us to do a deal together and a number of equity sources that you do business with, that we do business with, it took a long time eventually to do a deal with them, right? It doesn't happen overnight, but it's just you being out there talking to people and getting your name out and becoming an expert in the field.
The next podcast we do together, the first question will be, why did it take 10 years for us to do business together? But I'll leave that for the sequel. On a serious note, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it. I know you guys are busy.
Thank you.
And good luck to 24 and beyond.
Thanks,
Andrew. Absolutely. Thanks for having us on.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at scholarkirsch.com. And on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and for sharing the show with others.